This past week, I read John Grisham's new book, The Reckoning. Since A Time to Kill, it's his best novel, I think. It's about a family that is ravaged by World War II in rural Mississippi. And the interesting paradox of this upstanding family with religion, but not enough transformative power to overcome what things like the Bataan Death March did to a family and did to an individual. I think it's his best novel. And it set an interesting context to this message today. But we also, Sherry and I, we watched the new Netflix original production, Daredevil. And I'm a superhero geek, and Sherry is sort of along for the ride. But Daredevil is the most underrated of all the superhero movies and TV shows that have been done. And the reason is because the Daredevil has the best origin story of all the superheroes. It's better than being bitten by a spider or being born in Krypton. It is about a guy who grew up Catholic and struggling with what life has thrown at him with his faith in God. And there's this constant horizontal and vertical tension that Daredevil lives in. How do I reconcile a God with all the evil I see going around me? And Kingpin represents that evil. We all live within that tension, don't we? And Jesus came, and in Matthew 5, 6, and 7, he showed us how to live at the intersection of those tensions. Now, last week, we looked at the horizontal realities and his vision that would allow us to rise above trying to manage people on this horizontal plane of our relationships with one another. And I know you guys didn't need any reminders to do not judge and don't look for the plank or speck in other people's eye with the plank in your own eye and don't be a pearl pusher. I know you guys didn't need that, right? Interesting conversations. One conversation that I was told, husband and wife are elbowing each other through the whole pearl pusher thing. Like, don't, which if you were not here, that the point of that is don't be pushing your nuggets of wisdom onto all people all the time. And wife leans over to her husband, who's a coach, and said, you know what that means is not every conversation has to end with a lesson. Isn't that good? Like, if Jesus were here today, he'd have written that down and said, I'm using that in my next Sermon on the Mount. Okay? He would have said that. And so, you know, we all live within that tension of God and people and the mess at that intersection that's called life, right? And it's amazing how the key to human relationship is when you reach the place of love where you don't feel the need to change people and you get out of condemnation engineering. That's what Jesus was getting at here. But today we follow the part where he then turns toward the vertical dimension, and that is your relationship with your Heavenly Father. And as we close out this series next week, and you know, partly today really, this is what he's focusing on. Now I have a dog that's the best dog in the world. And Rafa is just this amazing dog. And every day when I come home, Rafa acts like he has not seen me for years. Does your dog do that to you? Like, it's like, oh my gosh, I have missed you so much, he says to me with his eyes and with his tail. And he just, oh, and if by chance I don't greet him appropriately and I just kind of blaze on by him, he sort of is on his haunches and he kind of gives me this look like, your dog ever do that to you? Now, when we had a cat and I'd walk in, the cat would look at me and go, you again. You know, but the dog, you know, loves you. And then there's this moment where if I haven't given him appropriate affection, I'll just feel guilty. Anybody ever go through that where you feel guilt with your dog? Some of us approach our faith in God that way. Like, I know God's been good to me, and I blow God off, and I sort of feel guilty about it, so here I am. I go to church to hopefully make up for it. And I do God stuff every once in a while to hopefully make up for the fact that I'm really not that focused on God most of the time. And if that is you, I'm going to set you free from that today. As in the second part of this series, we talked about rise above religion, and today we come right back again to it. Jesus says the same thing in a different way and how to rise above religion again. Because here's the comparison between religiosity and relationship. And God is not calling you to religion, where you do a bunch of religious stuff that is an end in itself. He is calling you to a relationship. And look at the difference between these. Religiosity is all about external behavior modification. You know, be a good citizen. Be a good Christian. You ever heard that phrase? He's a good Catholic. He's a good Baptist. He's a good Christian. And usually what that means is they follow the conform, they follow the rules. But Christianity is not about that. Christ is about an internal transformation that you're not trying to externally keep yourself under control. That is genuinely, there's a transformation that has happened. Your desires have changed. Religiosity is fear-driven. Oh, I got to do the right stuff because God might zap me. After all, he is the junior high principal who's looking to give you a whack with the Board of Education. And relationship, though, is about love. It's about, no, my gosh, I've been set free, and now I have love, and you only can love to the degree you've been loved, you believe you've been loved, and so now you're free to love at this unbelievable capacity. Religiosity is guilt-driven. Oh, I've just, you know, I blew off God when I came in the door, and now I got to make it up to God because he's kind of offended by that. But relationship is grace-driven. It's, oh, no, 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 I've already been so blessed. I love it when I can sing to God with other people. I don't do it because I have to. I just love it when I can gather with other people and like this God concert and say, yay, God. I love that. Religiosity is very exclusive. It draws boundary lines. Religion is very country clubbish. We're in this club, you're not. Right? We're in this club, you're not. You're going to see why that's a real problem with Jesus. And yet relationship is very inclusive. It doesn't draw lines. It has such a security. It doesn't need to say, I'm in the club, you're not, and that gives me security. It doesn't need to do that. And religiosity is all about what you do. Do you do enough to climb the rung to God? And relationship is about what God has already done to come down the ladder to you through Jesus. Now, Southbrook. Which is more attractive, the person living the left side or the person living the right side? Which one is more attractive? Which one do you think our world would go, man, if our world had more people like these people? Which one is it? Left side, right side? Right side. I mean, we know that. You can be here today and you're not a Christ follower. You're not even, maybe you're an atheist. But you would go, oh yeah, man, I might even be a believer if there were more people like that. Right? So here's what I want to do today and next week. Today I'm going to share two of them. Next week I'm going to share four of them. Four ingredients of every healthy relationship. And then I want you to see how these apply to your relationship with God. Okay? So we're going to cover two of them today, two of them next weekend. And here they are. Every healthy relationship has this giving and this asking and receiving dynamic. Every healthy relationship participates in asking and receiving. As Jesus transitions into now you and God, he says, remember, verse 7, ask and it'll be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. Everyone who asks receives. The one who seeks finds. And the one who knocks, the door will be opened. Look what he says about God and how he looks at you. Which of you, if your son asks for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, we'll give him a snake. If you then, though you are evil, in other words, you're flawed, you're messed up, you know how to give good gifts to your child, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him? In other words, what he's saying is this. He's saying your relationship with God is not one of religiosity where you hope you do enough good things where you can bend God's will your way. Your relationship with him is, I so trust my Heavenly Father that when I have a need, when I have a want, I ask him about it. I don't edit my wants because of religion. Like, yeah, you know, you shouldn't ask for that, right? You shouldn't ask for that. No, I don't edit my wants. And the reason why is because when you ask God and you don't edit your wants, you just say, because is there a chance he already knows anyway? When you just ask, your desires are then put on the table. They're put on the table. And in that asking and seeking and knocking, you don't realize it, but every one of those is a cable weaving the bridge of a relationship with him. And before you know it, you wake up someday and you go, all this asking and seeking and knocking has developed an authentic relationship with him where I trust God. In the Message Bible, verse 7 says, don't bargain with God, be direct, ask for what you need. Now, would it surprise some of you that I have actually, don't think the less of me for this, I have actually prayed during football games for certain outcomes. I have. It is so infantile, but I have. And part of the reason is, God, you said ask for everything. And I'm asking right now. I'm asking right now, God, I'm desperate for a Browns win this weekend, man. And we'll see if God answers my prayer today, okay? Probably not. It's, you know, but with God, all things are possible, right? With God, all things are possible. And so here's the thing on this. Dallas Willard said it so well. Asking is the great law of the spiritual world through which important things are accomplished in cooperation with God and also in harmony with the freedom and worth of every individual. A healthy relationship contains a balance of asking and receiving, asking and receiving. This is why God does not just give us what we need without being asked. See, this is the same thing Jesus said in Matthew 6 earlier when he said, hey, God already knows what you need before you ask him. So don't babble. Don't try to twist God's arm with religious talk. Like if you say it religiously, God might hear you. There's a code. You got to use a God voice, and you got to say the God code in Jesus' name. That's how we take that. It's like it's the magic barcode that allows your prayers to be heard. He says, no, don't do that. God already knows what you need. But why does then, if he knows what you need, why does he say he wants you then also to ask him? It's because in the asking and receiving, you know how the Golden Gate Bridge was built? And many of you know I have a miniature model of the Golden Gate Bridge on my desk to remind me that the Golden Gate Bridge started with one piece of rope, and then another piece of rope, and then cables, and then cables. And before long, the Golden Gate Bridge was spanning the expanse of San Francisco Bay. Why? Because that's how faith gets built. That's how our bridge and our connection to God gets built, is in asking and receiving. Now, sometimes God says no. Are you kidding me? Sometimes God, I think he goes, what? Are you kidding me? Right? No. Sometimes he says slow. The timing's not right. Sometimes he says grow. You're not ready for it. And sometimes he says, go. Now listen, Southbrook. Here's when you know you have a relationship with God, is when you're willing to trust his no as much as you are willing to trail his go. When you're willing to say, God, you didn't give me what I asked, and I'm just going to trust you on that. And when he says, hey, go for it. We're going on this. I'm answering this. And you go, all right. When you trust one as much as you trail the other, you're not religious anymore. You have a relationship that is a strong bridge that is impenetrable. Because it's not based on circumstance, it's not based on feeling, it's based on I trust. I've learned to trust that God, whatever comes from his hand, and when I can't trace his hand, I can trust his heart. That as a father gives good gifts to his children, if your son or daughter asks for a pet boa constrictor and they're 5 years old, you might start with a goldfish, right? Jesus said, if you know that a 5-year-old can't handle a boa constrictor, you might start with an aquarium. God probably is every bit that wise, right? God probably is every bit that wise. I've prayed for motorcycles. I have. I've prayed, and my wife is praying against it, and so she is winning so far in the prayer thing, right? Because she knows probably what I would do with it. All motorcyclists come in second place in crashes, right? Yeah, and so sometimes God knows, and in that weaving, a relationship gets built. Now, do you remember what comes next in this section? You do. When I remind you, you do. Because if you've not been in church in 30 years, you know Matthew 7:12. Anybody ever heard of the golden rule? Look what he says next. And you wonder, what does this connect? How does this connect with asking, seeking, and knocking on God? When he says, so in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. That's how God treats you. For this sums up the law and the prophets. You can summarize the whole Bible in one statement. Just simply be proactively, energetically, joyfully, willingly able to act for others as you would hope others would act for you. Now, is there a more attractive person on the planet than the person who lives by the golden rule intrinsically? Like, they don't do it because, okay, Jesus said I got to do this. Is there any less attractive person who is so insecure that their rule is get other people before they get you? That's the person you don't want to do business with. Because they're so insecure, they see life through the lens of everybody's out to get them, and they're like a caged, cornered animal, and they're looking for an angle and everything. There's just such an insecurity there. On the contrary, the person who has the security to say, you know what? I live in my Father's world. I'm secure enough. I can give a coat to someone who asks me, and not only do that, but give my outer garment as well. Why? Because I'm secure. I can go 2 miles when I'm forced to go 1 mile. Why? Because I'm secure. I don't need to get my way anymore. I don't need to prove who's in charge anymore. And the reason that Jesus connects this with asking, seeking, and knocking is the person who has the security enough with God to ask and seek and knock, and they know their provision is coming from God and he's doing everything that he can to resource them, that's the person who can live the golden rule. That's the person who's able to do proactively for their world what they would hope their world would do for them. Every healthy relationship, marriage, friendship has a reciprocity dynamic to it of asking and receiving. Every healthy relationship has the element of I trust your no as every bit as much as I trail your yes. And it's true of you and God. It's true of you and God. When you have that, now you have a relationship that is an impenetrable bridge that nothing in this world can tear apart because it's not based on circumstance. It's based on trust. Well, here's the second one. And the second one is every healthy relationship contains restrictions that lead to freedom. This is true. Every healthy relationship has certain exclusivity about it. Certain, that's why Randy's doing the class tomorrow, boundaries, right? But those very restrictions lead to greater freedom. Here's what he says. Verse 13, enter through the narrow gate. For wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. Whew. Now we're getting to the heart of the collision of Christ and our culture. Here's how the narrative typically goes. And it comes out of this very statement that Jesus made. Here's the typical narrative. Christianity calls certain beliefs wrong. It calls certain behaviors immoral. It restricts human freedom by telling people how they must think and how they must live. Christians believe they know absolute truth. Therefore, they believe people who disagree with them are wrong and condemned before God. Christians are therefore intolerant. Is that a pretty accurate assessment? I think it is. And the thinking with this goes, humility, therefore, demands that we give up any sense that we can know truth, that any one person can know truth. The idea goes with this, nobody can really claim to know what is true, and to claim that you can know anything that is true is arrogant, which, by the way, is a statement of absolute truth, which is either true or it's not true. I have my truth, you have your truth, nobody really knows, we're in no position to call anybody else wrong, and so we will live with tolerance. Has anybody heard that phrase, tolerance? We need to have tolerance and acceptance to each other. And I think that's a pretty accurate assessment of how this collision of Christ and culture is going on all around us. Does anybody live within the intersection of that tension? We all do. And if you're a Christian, then you are an intolerant bigot, is the conclusion. John Ortberg pointed something out that I'd never seen before. He said, but if you look closely at the life of Jesus, you see a very different paradox going on. Jesus was very narrow in his relationship with his heavenly Father, very focused. What came out of that was some very audacious statements about himself. but he was very broad in his relationship with people. Very broad in his attractive acceptance of people. Put it this way. For example, he made claims that were stunningly audacious. I am the way, the truth, and the life. You want to come to the Father? Come through me. He said, if you've seen me, you've seen God. You've seen, oh my gosh. Now see, there's someone who says that is either a liar, a lunatic, or they are who they said they are. As C.S. Lewis famously said. He said this, I have come to show you the one true God. Wow, all three of those statements, very politically incorrect in our culture, very narrow in their focus in his relationship with his Heavenly Father and the expression of himself through that. That same guy touched untouchable lepers. You legally were not allowed to touch lepers. He heals a guy. He doesn't have to touch him to heal him, but he touches him. Why? Because he wanted that man who had been ostracized by his community for having leprosy to know what it was to experience human touch. He was having compassion for that man. Jesus allowed a prostitute to wash his feet with her hair. Now, if I had someone come up here today who's not my wife, wash my feet with her hair, would y'all be uncomfortable with that? You can't even fathom what it was like for a rabbi to let a prostitute serve him in that intimate way. I mean, it was just unprecedented. The statement of broad acceptance. Jesus, one time, he affirmed the faith of a Roman centurion. If I said, hey, I got a Taliban officer who's one of my buddies, and I came up here today and say, you need to have faith like this Taliban officer. You guys would go, what is going on? Jesus went to parties with tax collectors. This was the equivalent of going to a mob dinner in Little Italy. Okay? I mean, his narrow focus on his Heavenly Father and the expression of his identity out of that was unbelievably audacious. And yet, within that, his broad acceptance of people who were the untouchables, who were the rejected by the religious establishment, was unprecedented. You just didn't do it. And be called a rabbi. And this is important. Why? Because this is what Jesus means when he talks about the narrow gate that leads to freedom. There's an incredible story in Luke 17 of the time when Jesus heals 10 lepers. Look it up. At least one of them, all of them except at least one, were Jewish. One of them was a Samaritan. Samaritans were the evil, hated half-breeds. They came as a result of Israel being in Babylonian captivity and intermarriage happening between Israelite and Babylonian, and the Samaritans were hated. The lines were drawn in their religions and their expressions of their relationship with God. And I'd never seen this until this week. This is the cool thing about studying the Bible your whole life is you just learn new stuff. And Jesus heals them, and one of them comes back and says, thank you. Which one was it? It was the Samaritan. And Jesus says to all 10 of them, Luke 17, 14, he says to all 10 of them, go show yourself to the priests. Not priest, the priest. I'd never seen this until this week. This is a stunning statement. Because the Jews had their priests, and the Samaritans had their priests. By saying this, he was saying this. You go back. I'm not trying to convert you to my religion. I've healed you unconditionally. I've loved you and shown compassion on you. Now, I'm not trying to convert you to my religion. You had to go show yourself to the priest to be given the slip of you're clean now, you can enter the community. They were sort of like doctors in many ways, the clean bill of health. Now, you go do that, and I'm not trying to convert you. You Jews go to your priest, and you Samaritans go to your priest, because what he was saying there is a relationship with me transcends religion boundaries. It transcends the boundaries that people set up to be exclusive. This is a stunning, stunning statement of Jesus, the one who lived a very narrow gate in his relationship with the Father and expressed that in a freedom to love people broadly. The Barna Group is a research group that researches faith issues in America. And Barna Research Group studies these faith issues, and they have the data to show that American culture is increasingly divided and fractured. You are not imagining it. It's not just the result of social media. It is partly because of social media, probably, but it is real. We are very fractured, probably unlike any time other than 1968 in our recent history. They said most Americans think it would be difficult. Based on the data, listen to this. Most Americans think it would be difficult to have a natural and normal conversation with a Muslim, an atheist, or a member of the LGBTQ communities. It is just, I can't do it. I can't have a natural, normal conversation. What do you think, based on their data, was the one group that has the hardest time having a natural and normal conversation with minority groups? Evangelical Christians. Get this. The Barna Research Group found that not only do evangelicals have the hardest time having normal, natural, I don't need to change you conversations with Muslims, atheists, or LGBTQ community members, 28% of evangelicals cannot have a normal, natural conversation with other evangelicals. Now, friends, get this. Now, think about this. Do you know what the longest recorded conversation is in the Scriptures? Do you know what it is? The longest recorded conversation in the Scriptures is in John chapter 4 when Jesus has a conversation at a well with a Samaritan. Not just a Samaritan, but a Samaritan woman. Rabbis didn't talk with women in public. She's a Samaritan woman who has been divorced 5 times and is now shacked up with the guy that she's living with. And that's the longest recorded conversation in history. His followers were just stunned by this. The religious establishment was offended by this. And it was a statement of his broad acceptance of people. I'm not trying to convert you. My job is to just be your friend. That man's followers in this country are now the most exclusive people in the country. Do we have a problem, friends? Do we need to rise above? If you're a follower of Jesus, you are called to live with such a reality of his righteousness in your life that you have a fuel that allows you to rise above your need to change people. The relationship you have with God is so focused and narrow that it just pours vertically into your life a righteousness and a love that is from another place, so that that righteousness just pours down and spills out on a broad level. I had someone ask me a couple of weeks ago a question I have never been asked before. They said, I just love the way you teach and I love what you say, but I love the way you say it. I love that. And they were just being real supportive. But they said this. They asked me a question. I've never been asked this question before. What gives you the right to do that? Isn't that a great question? Because a lot of you have wondered that. Who has given him, who does he think he is to stand up there? And I thought that was a great question. And it took me off guard for just a moment. And I thought about it. And I said, I think this is why. I feel zero need to change people. I don't feel like I'm the mail carrier. Okay, I'm just delivering the mail. But if you want to read the mail, I don't care. It's up to you. My job's to deliver the mail. And I'm not on the management committee, I'm on the love committee. Because that's what he called me to be on. And I said, you know what? I think that's what, if I have an authority that people trust, I think it's that. I don't feel the need to say, now conform to my way. And if you trust that, maybe that's just a hint of, it's a little bit, maybe Jesus is living in me a little bit. And that this is what he calls us to. He calls us in a culture where Christians are very lax in their relationship with God and very narrow in their acceptance of other people. He says, no, friends, we've got to be the opposite. We've got to be people who say, I hunger and thirst for your righteousness. When I plant my feet on the floor every morning, I am saying, God, your kingdom come through me. Your will be done through me from the inside out. And my job is I'm on the love committee. I'm not on the management committee. I have, you know, friends at this church who are gay and lesbian. I've asked some of them to walk in this journey with me. I don't know what it's like to be gay and lesbian in a church where some of you have been called out in a church for being transgender. I don't know what that's like. So help me. Help me understand. And they know that my conscience when it comes to the new covenant is I can't do your wedding. No more than I could do a polygamous wedding. Like, to me, marriage is, there's a reason why it's one man, one woman representing the divine of the male and the female coming together as a symbol of you are a miniature church. And they know that. Because I say, listen, I'm going to love you right up to that point, and I'm going to love you through that point. I have a real problem with abortion. I mean, it is, if I ever quit local ministry, it's because I went into the area of trying to have solutions when it comes to little kids. Because it has hit my family personally. And women who live with that and men who live with that. But when we talk about this next year, what we're going to say is if you are a doctor and you are here and you are performing abortions, we're going to love you. We're going to love you. If you're a woman and you've had an abortion, we're going to love you. We're going to let love be the healing that happens in your life. If this afternoon you go out and you have an abortion, we are going to love you because our job is not to be on the management committee. Our job is to be on the love committee. And that doesn't mean I'm for abortion because it is, to me, it's an evil. It's an evil. You see, listen, gang. Why could Jesus do this? Why was he relentlessly narrow in his focused devotion to God and outrageously broad-minded in his relationship? It's because he was full of love, and love narrows and broadens. Love narrows your focus on God, and it broadens your acceptance of people. That's what it does. That's one of the ways you know you're not a religious person anymore. 33 years ago, I married Sherry Young. 33 years ago. That restricted my life. Okay? I have restricted myself to Sherry Young. But I stand here today, that broadened my relationships with so many people because literally in front of me right now are hundreds of brothers and sisters that I would not have if I had not lived within the narrow gate of a marriage of fidelity to her. You see, every relationship has exclusivity about it at a certain level that leads to the definition of broad relationship. Every relationship does. And this is true of you. This is true of God. Why Dallas Willard called the community of Jesus, the church, the community of prayerful love. Now, I want to say something here on this. This is, they'll get at the core, why as a church, I wanted us to understand the rise above message in the Sermon on the Mount. Do you remember a few weeks ago when I read from Matthew 5 and I read these words, you have heard it said to the people long ago, hate your enemies, but I say to you, tolerate your enemies. Do any of you remember when I said that? No, you don't remember who said that because that's not what Jesus said. That's not what he said. Not one time did he say, tolerate each other. He said, you heard it said to the people long ago, hate your enemies, but I say to you, love your enemies. Tolerance comes from the Latin word tolerentia, which means to put up with or endure. We were not made for tolerance. We were not made to tolerate each other. We were made to celebrate each other and let God do the management of each other. Ortberg points out, he said, for example, when I married Sherry, for example, Sherry did not stand at the altar, thank God, and say, I promise to tolerate you until death do us part. For better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, until death sets me free from enduring you. That's not what she said. What did she say? I promise to love and cherish. When you tuck your little ones in at night, you don't say, good night, sweetie. Sweet dreams. I tolerate you so much. That's not what you say, is it? At birthday parties, we don't sing, I tolerate you, No, we don't sing that, right? We celebrate one another because intrinsically we know we were not made to tolerate each other. We were made to celebrate each other. Some of you are thinking, that might be a good song to sing at our next birthday party, at party in our family. But you were not made by your creator to be tolerant. You were made to be infused with a vertical dimension of divine love so much that you can celebrate people who are very different from you that you don't understand. That you don't understand. I grew up in a biracial family. We are the Heinz 57 of families. We've got African-American and Irish and Indian and I mean just, and I thought I knew what it was like to be racial, to be biracial in America. I didn't know what it was like until I started doing intentional reading on it. Right now I'm reading Keis Lehman's book, Heavy, what it's like to be an African-American man growing up in Mississippi in the 80s. What it's like. Because if you're white like me, you don't know what it's like. And every interaction I have with someone who's different from I am, that is an opportunity to be so broad with this love that is just waiting to come out of me sideways. You see, Jesus did not call a single person to be a Christian. You know that? If by Christian you mean someone who follows these institutional rules, and when you were 8 days old, your butt got wet, and so you're in the club. You have been barcoded in. You have the fire coverage on your insurance policy, and you're in. But what he did call is he called people to be his disciples, which means apprentices in life. The one who conquered life and death. No, the one who mastered life and death said, now you apprentice under me and I will show you how to master life and death. And he knew this. Freedom is not about not having restrictions. Freedom is about having the right restrictions. That's what freedom is. And when he talked to his followers, look at what he said. John chapter 8, verse 31 and 32, Jesus said, if you hold to my teaching, you really are my apprentices, my disciples, then you will know the truth. And say it with me, and the truth will set you free. Who's freer? The person in this room right now who's going, I can't love people that are different from me. And the person who says, oh man, this resonates with my soul. Who's freer? The person who's living within such a narrow focus on God that allows that love to spill out sideways, that person is the free person. They're not going around drawing lines in the sand and boundaries and all this. They are going around sweeping those lines away and saying, you are my brother, you are my sister. You see, freedom is not about not having restrictions. Freedom is finding the restrictions you were made for. That's freedom. I was thinking this week when I was in college, my roommate and I had two pet piranhas. Yeah, and they were awesome. And we came up with a scheme to make money when we fed the piranhas because people wanted to watch it. So we started charging guys in the dorm to come into our room and watch us throw the goldfish into... These are the people who become your preachers, people, okay? All right? This is who you're listening to in your pews.
okay? And we would charge people for that. And it was, the glitter would just fly, and you know, amazing. And so there was a 20-gallon tank that held the goldfish, and on top of that was a 20-gallon tank that held the piranhas and a 10-gallon tank that held the goldfish. And one night, a friend of ours from another school was staying in our dorm room. He's 6 feet, 5 inches tall. He was sleeping on the floor between our beds, and in the middle of the night, he stretched his 6'5" frame out, and he pushed that 20-gallon tank against the frame of our stand and knocked over thank God it didn't land on him, and knocked the 10-gallon tank, feeder tank, over backwards. And there was just in the middle of the night this explosion. The image I remember from this is my roommate literally in his white Fruit of the Loom shouting and screaming in the middle of the night because it just sounded like a bomb had gone off. And in a moment, this glass exploded, and in a moment, those piranha and goldfish were free from the restriction of water. They were lined. We had like 30 goldfish and 2 piranha lined around our room where they just flowed out, because those fish were free from water. What would you say to that? What do you think happened to them? They died. The goldfish were going to anyways, probably a more merciful way to go. But they died. Why? Because fish were made for water. You take fish out of the restriction of water, they're going to die. You put a person in the restrictions of Jesus where they obey joyfully and creatively, not out of religious duty, but because I am privileged to apprentice under him, and that person will be free. That's the freest person you will ever meet, because you will know reality when you follow him, he claimed. Audacious, but I believe it's true. That reality will set you free. You see, the whole Sermon on the Mount points to this question at the end. Whose disciple are you going to be? Everybody here is a disciple of somebody. Everybody. You have bought some worldview. You have bought some system. Some of you, you may be a disciple of success and image and addiction and wealth. That may be your rabbi. You take your cue from what that rabbi says to do. Jesus never called one person to be a Christian. He called everybody he met, lepers and prostitutes and Roman centurions, follow me. Learn how I have mastered life. Watch me go to a cross intentionally, because the person who can do that is free, man. And watch me master death. And you will too. I ask you the question, Southbrook, which is more attractive, religiosity or a relationship like that? Which is more attractive? Next weekend is Big Splash Weekend. And I was thinking of this week. I was thinking of this. Some of you have seen Big Splash Weekends where we immerse people in the act of martyrs who said, we're going to go, we're going to do this, we're going to identify with the resurrected Christ. And I was thinking about how every person who gets baptized out there in the atrium next weekend, every one of you will walk up a narrow stairway. So next week when we celebrate this, for those of you who are ready to do this, and you got to ask yourself, what's holding you back from doing this? It's just, do I trust that that narrow gate leads to freedom? That life is not about not having restrictions. Life is about knowing what the restrictions are that we were made for. And when you walk up those stairs next week, you're getting immersed into the way that leads to life. This is not about getting to heaven. When Jesus said, few are those who find this way, he wasn't saying most people are going to hell, but a few of you are the elect. That's not what he was saying. He was saying, generally speaking, most people miss that this is what freedom is. Most people miss that finding the right restrictions is what freedom is all about. That's what he was saying. But if the Son sets you free, you'll be free indeed. If you trust that, you are ready to walk up the narrow gate of those steps next weekend
And we will take you every step of the way as you do this. This is your chance, Southbrooker, to say, I have been a disciple of success and wealth and addiction and image and all these things long enough. I want to be an apprentice of Jesus. Start it tomorrow morning when you wake up and you say, Father, as I plant my feet on my bedroom floor, my Father who fills the space around me, who fills all of the heavens right now, I set your name apart. Your rule come into my life today. Your will be done through me on every step of the earth that I walk on as it's being done in the realm of heaven right now. Give me today what I need, and I'll be so thankful for that. I'll live a gracious, gratitude-based life. And forgive me when I mess up, and make me gracious to people who offend me. Don't lead me down trials you know I can't handle. Deliver me from the evil one, because it is your rule. It is your strength. It is your magnificence that I want people to see in my life, both now and forevermore. And everyone said, Amen. See you next week for part 11 of Rise Above.